thank you, Gordon, for having 1 Kings 19 read. It came up a couple weeks ago in the Bible readings, 18 and 19. And, you know, I probably read it 20 times, but sometimes you're in a different place and you're thinking different things, and all of a sudden hits you in a different way. The contrast between 1 Kings 18 and 1 Kings 19 couldn't be any more startling. The contrast between 18 and 19 couldn't be any more sharp. It's like night and day when you read these two chapters. Take a look at chapter 18, if you would. In chapter 18, Elijah is bold and courageous. Elijah is almost cocky in chapter 18 in his confidence as he faces down hundreds of Baal's priests in this challenge of fire. You know, hundreds against one, and he's not afraid at all. He's incredibly brave and extremely, you know, strong in his faith. As he faces this powerful, evil queen, and he just victoriously embraces this challenge. And any roadblock that gets put in front of him is no problem. He plows right through it. And look at the end of chapter 18. Look how the chapter concludes in verse 46. And the hand of the Lord was upon Elijah, and he gathered up his garment, and he ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. The hand of the Lord was upon Elijah. Elijah experienced God's supernatural strength to do something extraordinary. What an awesome feeling that must have been. I mean, talk about having a good day. You know, I mean, you just called down fire from heaven. And Elijah ran home from that mountain, just feeling great about the God that he believed in, the God that he served, the living God. But then you get to chapter 19, which we read today, and it's a completely different Elijah. Now he's running scared. He's fearful. He's weak. He's exhausted. He's depressed. Elijah is actually suicidal in chapter 19. Why? What happened? What caused such a huge reversal of emotion? It's one single word: Jezebel. Look at the first couple of verses in 1 Kings 19. Ahab came home and he told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. And then Jezebel sent a message to Elijah: "So may the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." You know, just yeah. You know, in Elijah, look at the next verse. Elijah was afraid. Yeah. He arose and he ran for his life, and he came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and he left his servant there. This wicked witch was so powerful and so scary. She was so notorious for her evil deeds that when she threatens Elijah's life, it almost ends his life. When she sends him that message, it's game over for Elijah. Look at the next verse. Look at verse 4. He leaves his servant in Beersheba, and he himself went a day's journey out into the desert. And he came and he sat under a bush. And he asked the Lord that he might die, saying, "That's it. It's enough. No more. I'm done. take my life. Have you ever, been there? You ever been in that gloom of despair and defeat when all of your hopes and your expectations just explode in your face and everything you thought was going so good reverses and it blows up? I don't know what Elijah was expecting, but I know what I would have been expecting the day after Mount Carmel. With the power of God so clearly manifested the day before, I assume that Elijah would have thought there was going to be some change around here. There was a new sheriff in town. He was probably looking for some positive response from Ahab. Ahab would repent and there would be positive change in the kingdom of Israel. No longer would they worship these Baals. They'd worship the one true God. How else could you? How else could you? They had cried and they had cut themselves for 9 hours and nothing had happened. And Elijah went and it licked up the water. And the whole people saw it. And what he gets is the complete opposite of what he thought he was going to get. And it totally throws him. He goes into a funk that just spirals down and down and down. I think maybe that's the first lesson for us from Elijah. And it concerns our expectations and their impact on us. You see, I think Elijah was expecting something different. He was expecting something much more positive. He was looking for a real turnaround in the spiritual conditions of his ecclesia. He had just given them an amazing exhortation. He had just stood there and he had them. And every one of them was just touched. And he thought that they were going to be better. And it didn't happen. It was business as usual with Jezebel. You see, life is full of disappointments. And if you're not really careful, your expectations can derail you. And it's not wrong for us to hope for the best and to look to God to deliver. But you have to be careful that you don't get derailed in the process. Take a look at 1 Corinthians 13, if you would. There's a great verse in there. 1 Corinthians 13, verse 7. Those of you who have it memorized, don't have to look it up. 1 Corinthians 13, verse 7 says, love believes all things and hopes all things. Ah. That's the positive side. That's where you want to be, right? Love believes all things and hopes all things. I love you. And I'm hopeful that you're going to be, positively affected by what I say. But it also says, love bears all things and love endures all things. Take a look at the verse. Did you notice that believing and hoping is kind of sandwiched in between bearing and enduring? Things don't always happen the way we expect them to happen. And we have to have patience. We have to have faith. We have to have trust that God is going to take care of it in His time. God holds us responsible for trusting in Him, for obedience, for love, for endurance, and for faithfulness to do what He's asked us to do. But He does not hold us responsible for the results. That doesn't mean you don't have to do it. You have to be faithful. You have to endure. But you're not responsible for what happens. The results are in God's hands, not ours. You see, we can't change people. That's the one thing that it takes a long time to eventually learn. You can't change people. And we often can't even change our own circumstances. But God can. We can change our attitude about how we're going to look at things. It's the only thing we have control over is how we are going to think about this circumstance, how we're going to think about this person. See, wanting everything to go your own way, it's not only unrealistic, it's kind of self-centered. You have to realize that not everything is going to go your way. And it requires some faith that God has a bigger plan in place. In Philippians, Paul writes, "Rejoice in the Lord always, and again I say, rejoice." Do you ever stop and think about where he was when he wrote that? What kind of position he was in? Was everything going his way when Paul said, "Oh, rejoice in the Lord always"? No, he was in jail. He was chained to a Roman soldier because he was awaiting trial, a trial that was probably going to end in his death. And he says, rejoice. He said it while people were seeking to do him harm. Even members in the ecclesia were seeking to do him harm. And he says, rejoice. Go back to 1 Kings 19. Let's take a look at what happens to Elijah here. 1 Kings 19, verse 4 tells us that Elijah fled to Beersheba. Now, Beersheba is way, way, way down in the south. So he has a really, really bad experience, and he goes to Mexico. I just want to get away from everything, everyone I know. Beersheba was a desert place, like Baja. But even that wasn't enough. He leaves his servant there, and he goes wandering out past the city, a whole day's journey, out into the desert. And he sought some shelter. Not in God, but in this bush, this scrubby bush, this broom tree. Nowhere in 1 Kings 19 do we find Elijah calling on the Lord. Nowhere do we find Elijah seeking God's direction. The problem was not that Elijah arose and ran, because that happens. That's part of life. That's part of our experience. The problem wasn't that he went down in the desert to hide. God doesn't hold him, God doesn't call him to blame for that. The problem was that Elijah does this without asking for God's direction. Without calling on God as his primary shelter. Instead, he decides where he wants to go, and he looks for some bush to be his shelter. So we find Elijah discouraged, depressed, and hiding, and failing to minister to the people, which was his job as a prophet. This is what people call burnout. This is what you're seeing here in Elijah. His job is a prophet, but he's experiencing a serious case of burnout. His actions were not the actions of faith or fellowship. His actions were the actions of desperation, of depression. He was acting the opposite of faith, the opposite of fellowship. He wanted to be all alone out in the desert. Just like the rest of us, Elijah experienced this depression. James says that Elijah was a man with a nature just like us. And he came to that sad place, all alone. Depression is the mental and emotional condition that's marked by feelings of discouragement and worthlessness and dejection and guilt and failure. And life is very much like a roller coaster. It has its ups and its downs. It has its moments of depression and its moments of manic happiness, right? And the tendency, I think, is for us to experience happiness and joy, to base our significance and our security on where we are on that ride, when it's up or it's down. And I think that's one of the mistakes we make, We can't base our happiness. We can't base our sense of self on where we are on that ride, because it's going to change. It's going to go down. It's going to go back up. It's going to take a twist and a turn that you didn't see coming. Now, every one of us has to ride it. But we don't have to be dominated by it. We don't have to have our lives controlled by it. We can learn to ride it with a great deal more spiritual and mental and emotional stability. Regardless of whether we're in the peaks or the valleys or even on the level places, we can be more stable. Spiritual stability is one of the blessings, I think, that comes from our salvation in Christ. We experience it as we learn to keep our focus on God and His purpose for us and His plan for our lives. And we have faith in God's principles and God's promises. That we're not focused on where we are and how up or how down or how, you know, how our journey is, but on where God is in our life. Turn back to that Philippians chapter 4. There's a couple more verses there. Philippians chapter 4, starting at verse 11, he says, "Not that I'm speaking of being in need, for I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content." Philippians 4, verse 11, "In whatever situation I'm in, I've learned to be content. When I'm down, when I'm up, I've learned to be content. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. I can do all things through Him who strengthens me." When your faith is on Christ, when your faith is in God, and your focus is on something that doesn't change, that's unchangeable, your life becomes a little more stable. But even the strongest of us sometimes lose sight of that faith. And we get lost or we crash and burn emotionally. And Elijah had just called down fire from heaven. And he quickly becomes a classic illustration of a depressed person. You find in his thinking and his words and his actions many classic symptoms of depression. First of all, withdrawal, moodiness, fear, self-pity, feelings of worthlessness, a loss of confidence, a irritable and anger and physical exhaustion are some of the classic symptoms. It's a devastating, debilitating sickness that affects the whole person, your spirit, your soul, and your body. And it negatively impacts your spirituality, your emotionally, and you physically. Elijah had just experienced this amazing victory on Mount Carmel with a long-time goal in his life accomplished. He was able to stand there in front of the nation and show his God to be the one God, the true God. And God was proven to be the only God. The people had worshipped the Lord for the first time in years as the true God. And the Baal prophets had been put to death. But times like this are also a really vulnerable time. A time where you can easily be let down. See, Elijah had just expended a great deal of energy, both physical and spiritual. It truly was a mountaintop experience for him, but now he needed to watch out for the valleys that inevitably follow those mountaintop experiences. And he wasn't ready for it. And as soon as Jezebel heard of the victor of Elijah, she sent her threat to him. And his expectations for revival and reformation were dashed into pieces. That should have rolled off his back. What he just saw, the power of God that he knew and he was confident existed, some woman sending you a message trying to scare you, shouldn't have bothered him at all. But it does. It knocks him for a loop. Elijah got his eyes off the Lord and he got scared. And he ran for his life down to the desert. He was all alone. And he was tired. And he was exhausted. And he was in the wilderness by himself without any food or out any water. He was planning on dying. Best way to do it is to get all alone out in the middle of the desert with no water or no food. But he wasn't really alone, was he? God was with him. He felt totally alone. He felt helpless and fearful and hurt. He felt like a complete failure. But God was there. And look what it says. It says God sent an angel to minister to him. I'm just so impressed about how gently and lovingly God deals with Elijah during this time. I would have probably said, buck up. Look at all the good things. You just had this great victory. God doesn't do that. God doesn't chastise him or criticize him for losing his faith or for having a moment of weakness. Only days after this faith-strengthening event on Mount Carmel, God was patient and loving with Elijah. And he met Elijah where he was. I love it how God, it's almost like he says, by the way, there are still 7,000 people around who haven't bowed down to Baal. Elijah's thinking, he's the only one, he's all alone. And God tells him no. God wanted him to know that he was not alone. Not only was God with him, no matter how far out into the wilderness he went, no matter how far in the desert he got, God was with him. But, he was not alone too. There was 7,000 others who were there. God truly understood this depression that Elijah was in. He does an amazing job of providing some real help. And I think there's four things I want to point out that we see that God does that is a really positive and helpful way to help somebody who we find in that position. First one, you notice that before he deals with Elijah's spiritual condition, the first thing he does is he deals with Elijah's physical condition. He rejuvenates Elijah physically. He gives him rest and he gives him nourishment. Look in verse 5 and 6. The angel touched him and said, "Arise and eat." And he looked, and behold, and there was at his head a cake baked on hot coals and a stone and a jar of water. And he ate and he drank and he lay down again. God understood that we're not going to go anywhere spiritually or mentally unless our body can carry us. And Elijah needed some rest and he needed some food. And the second thing, God gets Elijah to face his true condition. He draws Elijah out and forces him to face the problem. Notice here, twice God asks Elijah the same question. And he asks him, "Why are you here? Why are you here, Elijah?" In other words, he's asking him, Take inventory of yourself. Think about what you've been doing. You see, personal reflection, meditation, self-examination, those are keys to this process. There's a great phrase, an old saying, it says, "Seek the headwaters of the river of pain." If you want to resolve some of these issues, you have to find where they start, what the source is. You have to find out why you are here. The fact is that you're crying and you're in bed and you're holding a bottle of alcohol. Why are you there? That's what God asked him. And look at number three. I love it that God gets Elijah up. And he gets him out. And he gets him doing something. He gets him active and involved in his ministry once again. Look at verse 15. God says, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria." God gives him a job. He gives him something to do. When feeling down or depressed, don't give in to that temptation to just mope around all day and don't do anything. Doing nothing only reinforces the depression. By the same token, you have to have proper rest, and you shouldn't use pointless activity as a drug for the pain. But rest and relaxation and solitude with the Lord needs the balance of involvement with work and activity in ministry. Out of a spirit of faith and service, not just for activity's sake, but because it's something good. Get up. Do something. Do something good for God. Be productive. And then the last thing, the fourth thing I noticed, God provides Elijah with a companion. Look at verse 19. He departed from there and he found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen in front of him, and he was with the 12. Elijah passed by him and cast his cloak upon him. Elijah didn't even know that he wanted a companion. Look at those first dealings in the relationship between Elijah and Elisha. He doesn't even want him. He throws the cloak on him. Well, is this for me? Oh, do what you will. And he storms off. And Elisha follows along behind him, because God was wise enough to know that Elijah needed a companion. And he gave Elisha to him. Elijah was trying to do too much himself. He was taking too much onto his own shoulders. And he had to learn to share that workload and to share that burden with someone else. Sometimes we have to learn to share our load, or even allow others to take our place. God cares about each one of us as much as he cared about Elijah. These four steps he goes through to bring Elijah back are the same kinds of things that God does for us and cares for us. He will work gently and lovingly with us to carry us through our down times. Because the down times will come. And God will be there for us when it happens. So I want to turn our attention now to these emblems. In a few minutes, Gordon's going to open up Luke 22. And he's going to read to you about Christ's final meal with his disciples. I want to have you read from that chapter first. Let's take a look at Luke 22. I want to close by turning our thoughts to Jesus' last day and what happened there. Luke 22, let's start towards the end, at 39. And he came out and went, as was his custom, to the Mount of Olives, and disciples followed him. And when he came to the place, he said to them, "Pray that you enter not into temptation." He leaves his servants there and goes off a little bit further to be alone, right? He withdrew from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt down and he prayed, and he said, "Father, if you're willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done." And look, there appeared to him an angel from heaven, strengthening him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. And his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. If you don't think Jesus understood what it was that Elijah went through, if you don't think Jesus understood depression and sadness, if you don't think he understood what it felt like to be betrayed, to be forgotten, to have your whole life's work made meaningless by the actions of others. This is a man who understood that. And in agony, his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. But in his lowest moment, Jesus turned to God. And he said, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." and God strengthened him. Jesus knew that no matter how low a valley you might be in at the time, God is always there for you. And God will be there to comfort you, to strengthen you. May each of us have the wisdom to do the same thing that Jesus did. When we find ourselves feeling all alone, when we find ourselves defeated, instead of saying, "It is enough, Lord, take my life," let us instead do what Jesus did. May we have the faith to say, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit."